Hi, welcome to the 4th Annual Online Conference for Moms Fighting Autism. I'm your host, Minta Green. We are very lucky to have with us today Elizabeth Frischkoff. Elizabeth is a Handle practitioner, and I'm going to turn the mic over to Elizabeth. Thank you so much for coming, Elizabeth, for agreeing to speak to this great audience, and thank you for sharing your knowledge with us today.
You're welcome. Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you. Can you tell us a little bit about Handle and who you are and floor is up to you. Okay, thank you, Elizabeth.
Sure, thank you very much, Minta. My name is Elizabeth Frischkoff. I'm a Handle practitioner and instructor, and my practice is based in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. And Handle stands for Holistic Approach to Neurodevelopment and Learning Efficiency, and it was developed by the founder, Judith Bluestone. Now, Judith was a remarkable woman. She personally treated over 4,000 individuals and families using Handle prior to her passing in 2009. And she developed Handle out of her own personal experience and her education. So Judith was born in the 1950s, and at a time when there was a lot of experimentation going on in chemicals and chemical engineering. Her father was a chemical engineer, and this was long before individuals knew that one should wash your hands or change your clothes when you leave the lab. And so he brought toxins home on him and in his body, and so she was chemically affected in utero and was born with chemical effect. She was missing cranial bones and areas in her brain, and it made it very difficult for her to develop in her early childhood. Even though she was a very cute little kid, she had difficulty learning to do things like talking. She didn't speak intelligibly until she was 9. So if the label had been around when she was a child, she would probably have had the label of autism. Because of the stimming behaviors that she had, she couldn't ride a bicycle, so she would turn it upside down and spin the wheels round and round and round. She did a lot of banging and thumping and behaviors like biting and screaming at times when things didn't work for her. And as with many individuals on the autistic spectrum, along with challenges come incredible gifts. And Judith had an incredible gift of being able to remember things that she saw and things that she experienced. She had an incredible ability to remember people and situations. And even in the years that I knew her, if I couldn't remember someone's name from a conference 3 years ago, I could call her up and ask her, and she would know exactly who I was talking about and be able to tell me who their spouse was, how many kids they had, where they lived. She just had an incredible categorizing memory. This served her incredibly well once her systems became organized enough that she could function and do well in school and go on to higher education. And when she went on to study special education and neurodevelopment and complementary medicines, she was able to draw from her personal experience. And that's why we say that Handle is based on both historical research and empirical evidence, as well as internal research and information. So it's built from the inside out, based on her experience as well as her research. Initially, Judith was able to study neurodevelopment and apply her experiences, apply her theories to her own life and her own work. That way, she then was able to go on to help others. And the Handle Institute was founded in the 1990s to help share her theories and her experience with others. The Handle Institute was established in 1994 as an organization to provide clinical services and training in the Handle approach. And the Institute also works to further develop the innovative understanding and methods that comprise the Handle approach And today, Handel practitioners can be found in 19 countries around the world and in 27 states of the United States. Judith was able to, as I said, learn from her own experience. Some of the things that she learned very intensely through were things like echolalia. In order to learn to speak, she had to listen over and over and over again to things. She listened to records. She listened to music. She listened to musical theater. And she had an incredible memory that she could recall anything. And it was very funny because some people, when they remember things, they remember them in connection to something else. And if you have a hard time learning to speak, sometimes you learn to speak through series and sequences, such as hello, how are you, fine, thank you. These are patterns and sequences that we can learn that help us socialize. And since she did a lot of hers through musical theater, if you said to her, shall we dance, she would keep going inside of her head or outside, depending on who she was with, shall we dance on a bright cloud of music? And she would go through the whole song from The King and I until she'd get to the end of it, and then she could continue on with her conversation with you. So those were some of her amusing sides as well. Judith was recognized for her work and for her contributions. In a number of different ways, she received in 1989 the National Annual Early Childhood Education Award in Israel. She was recognized in Who's Who in American Education in 1992, 94, 95. In 2002, she received the Case Western Review University Distinguished Alumni Award. And in 2004, she received the Jefferson Award for Outstanding Public Service and the Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis Award. And I have requested that you receive the link to the presentation that was given to her at the Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis Award ceremony, at the Jefferson Award ceremony. And if you would like to look at that, you're welcome to. Also, there is a wonderful interview with Judith and Rosemary Mason with an English television program that was done a few years ago. And it's a great opportunity to hear Judith describing her experiences and some of the thoughts that went into her founding of Handel. In a nutshell, Handel stands for Holistic Approach to Neurodevelopment and Learning Efficiency. The holistic is describing the whole person, that we're drawing from not just one area. We're drawing from many different things, understanding the nervous system, the immune system, the digestive system, visual system, so internal systems as well as external systems, family system, environmental systems, ecosystems. They all are interrelated, and they all have an effect upon us and how we function. And so Handel incorporates the knowledge from all of these different systems as well as from different principles and knowledge bases, neurodevelopment, immunology, and holistic health, reflexology, nutrition. We draw from many different things, recognizing that nothing stands alone. And in that, we are looking, recognizing that neuroscience, human development, visual processing, sensory motor integration, nutrition, education, and counseling all are interdependent and all have an effect on us. And the Handel approach, the A in Handel, recognizes that every person is an individual. And therefore, we can't just apply things as a very specific theory. That a theory is a great place to start, but it may not be true to the person themselves. So I see the approach and handle as being more of an artistic way of seeing someone and having a framework from which I am approaching them.
Elizabeth, I'm sorry, may I interrupt you for 1 second? Your slides are not moving.
I should be
are
on slide number five.
Oh, okay. Just make sure you're on
correct?
Slide number five.
Are you,
I can't see.
You can't see? All right.
No.
I think I'm on slide number five.
Okay. Thank you, Elizabeth. I'm sorry to interrupt.
Well, that's okay. So this talk is largely around part of the Handel theory, which is that behavior is communication. And that's a big component of addressing and recognizing the individual and seeing who they are. So if I am trying to understand how things work together, that systems are all interrelated, and that the individual that I'm meeting and facing is an individual, then I need to be open. And Judith described this as non-judgmental, holding a space for that person that is completely open to who they are and allow them to speak to me. Now, especially when somebody is nonverbal, their primary communication tool is going to be behavior. If you think about everyone when we start as human beings, we start not being able to communicate in any other way besides crying and looking, laughing, and nursing, and moving. And that would be how the young infant would be able to grow and move. And there's a lot of work that the young infant does with all of those things. For example, as the infant is being born, the cranial bones compress in order for the head to emerge from the vaginal canal. Now, in the case of a cesarean, then the head does not compress. It's actually a very healthy thing for the cranial bones to compress to a certain degree and then expand. And the expansion of the cranial bones, there's two ways that that can happen. One is through nursing and sucking, and the other is through crying. So crying and sucking are two very, very important activities for the young child. And as we develop, these movements continue to be helpful for us for connecting and releasing energy. So what does behavior tell us? Behavior is communicating what is going on and what is working and what is not working. There's many different ways that we perceive information from our environment. And a lot of these perspectives in Handel have been written up in a book called The Fabric of Autism by Judith Bluestone. And there's some wonderful descriptions in that book that I encourage you to read. You'll find it very interesting. So let's look at some behaviors. The question is there a reason for seemingly purposeless behavior? On this slide, you see somebody pulling at their shirt and pulling at their socks. So what is happening here? This person is communicating something. If the person is pulling at their socks, perhaps they're telling us something about the way that the sock feels or the way that their foot feels in the sock. Depending on whether the sock is cotton or synthetic, it may or may not be blocking an energy that they're trying to get out of their foot. Different socks have different texture. Some socks have seams in them. Pulling at the sock might be communicating that the feeling of the sock isn't working for me. When somebody pulls at their shirt, again, it could be something about the way that that shirt feels. That little tag in the back of the shirt might not be working for the person. So we are taking information in from many different places in our environment, and our systems are interacting to perform tasks, working in balance and harmony with each other. So we're receiving information from things like our sense of sight, hearing, and touch. And we're receiving information from our internal and external environments, our digestive system, our immune system. And when there's too much coming in from any of these systems, what happens is that our systems become stressed and overwhelmed and start to shut down in order to protect ourselves and to stop having to process information. Now, because some of our sensory perceptions are unconscious, we might be unaware that stress is happening or is accumulating. And in that situation, a lot of times our response is reflexive. For example, many people blink when they have bright light suddenly shining in their eyes. Now, if somebody is hypersensitive to light, they might blink frequently or rub their eyes frequently. And a behavior that somebody might see for an individual who's hypersensitive to light might be that you could see someone flapping their hands near their eyes in an attempt to make blinders or to limit or control the visual stimulation. So if you think that, what might hand flapping near the ears indicate? Maybe it's indicating that there's something going on with sound processing. Perhaps there's too much sound coming in. Or perhaps the vestibular system, the sense of balance, the semicircular canals are very, very close to the auditory processing cochlea and actually share the same fluid. So sometimes when there is an irregularity in the sense of balance, you might see some movement or some stimming behavior happening around the ears. Another thing that happens in that part of the body is regulation of pressure. If you take a moment and swallow, just swallow for a minute, you'll probably hear something clicking or moving inside your ear. Every time you swallow, we're regulating the pressure of our middle and inner ear through the eustachian tube opening and closing. So here's another possible reason why someone might engage in movements that are swallowing, moving their mouth, moving their jaw, flapping around their ears, flapping around their eyes. Perhaps they're trying to moderate stimulation or something that's coming into that area. So when there's too much coming in, whether it's smells, whether it's sight, sounds, whether it's visual stimulation coming in, whether it's toxins in our environment, whether it's food that we've eaten that's caused a digestive disruption, a toxic overload of any kind causes the systems to not function properly. And that toxic overload can in itself come from stress. When we have too much stress, that itself creates neurotoxins that need to be removed from the body. Now, unfortunately, when we are stressed, it makes it harder to remove the toxins from our body. And we tend to hold on to things. And there's been a lot of discussion with individuals on the autistic spectrum around holding on to too many toxins and heavy metals. And a lot of that has to be related to how they deal with stress in general. And it seems to be a cumulative thing, that the toxins build up and build up. So Handel is looking at where these toxins are coming from and how can we start to eliminate the stress, whether it's stress in the digestive system, whether it's stress in the environment, whether it's stress in the sensory perceptions.
Elizabeth, may I interrupt you for one moment?
Sure.
I'm going to advance the slides. What slide you're on? You're on slide 6
I
now?
Just did slide 9, and now I'm going to slide number 10.
Okay. Here's slide 10.
Do you want me to tell you when I'm moving on to the next slide?
Yes. Would you mind? Thank you.
Sure thing. So slide number 10 shows us two individuals who are demonstrating that they are stressed. Now, I wish this were an interactive seminar, which is how I often present this, and I could ask you what you see in these pictures and what these individuals are showing you. My guess is that you would tell me that the fellow over on the left is complaining about sound. He's got his fingers in his ears, and his face is showing us that he is unhappy with the situation. And probably there has been some kind of sound that he has experienced as an assault, and he's blocking that. There's also a bright light shining near him. Perhaps the light is bothering him. You can see that he's squinting, and there is a grimace on his face that could also be, I'm trying to block out and control this light from bothering me. The child on the right-hand side is a child who is showing us that the world is not working. This picture was taken immediately after a picture of her pattering around in the puddle, splashing and having a grand old time until she tripped. And then she got wet, and the world stopped working. Now my question is, are either of these children in a place, in a moment, where now is a good time to ask them to practice some spelling words or to do some reading with you? I'm hoping that all of you will say no. No, we need to change the situation. And that's exactly right. The situation needs to change. Both of these children are saying, stop, the world is not working for me. I need the world to change. Both of these individuals are protecting. They're showing us they need to change their vulnerable sensory systems right now and their environment. They need to change that. We all protect ourselves from our greatest vulnerability. And that's often why we react to others, because we're feeling violated. We're feeling assaulted. We're feeling assaulted by sound or by light or by touch or by smell or by our environment, and we cannot tolerate it. Many, many individuals have hypersensitivities or some kind of sensitivity. And when we're stressed, those sensitivities become greater. And we need to be able to protect ourselves. Now, unfortunately, many of those in our environment and our world don't really understand what our sensitivities are, or that we're different today. I know most of my girlfriends and I recognize that certain times in the month, it's not a good idea to ask us to do certain things because we might just jump out and scream at you. Now, many people, children, spouses, family members, learn to recognize that and learn to give some space to that. But what if that's all the time for you? And the other person doesn't realize that you're sensitive to smell and that by their wearing a cologne, they're attacking you. I don't know if any of the people on the phone have ever had their child come up and start trying to take their clothes off of them or off of a caregiver. It could be because they were wearing something that was offensive, either by smell or by the way that it looked. Perhaps they're wearing earrings that were jangling around and looked like they were going to attack them, or bracelets, or a striped pattern on their shirt, or even wearing synthetic fibers that are blocking their energy so they can't get the energy connection that they need. What is coming from us from the environment is making it so that we cannot respond in a healthy way when we feel like it's assaulting us. And when we're hypersensitive to our environment, others may not realize that they are committing innocent assaults to those with sensitivities. And by this, Handel then recognizes that nothing stands alone. Everything is interdependent. Everything is relating to each other. I want to tell you a little story about visiting a special needs school where I met a boy who is hypersensitive to sound, nonverbal teenager. And I had already learned that he was hypersensitive to the sound of fans and vacuum cleaners, anything that had a motor in it, he couldn't tolerate, and he would throw a fit. And I watched him being calm and quiet in a classroom setting, and then the class transitioned to the woodworking shop. When we came into the woodworking shop, he immediately started screaming and shaking himself. And two aides came right over, each one grabbed an arm and started to restrain him and calm him down. I looked around the room, and I saw on a high shelf above him, behind another object, I saw a fan. And it made me think, perhaps this boy is imagining what the sound would be if that fan were on, and is using mental rehearsal to come up with an experience of being assaulted by that fan, and that is causing him to be upset. And thinking that he was in an imaginative auditory response, I went over and I put my hands, I cupped them as two cups over his ears to protect him from auditory assault. And immediately he calmed down. Immediately his body relaxed and the caregivers were able to let go of his arms. And they looked at me and they said, "What did you do? How did you know that?" And I said, "It's not magic. I just looked around the room. I looked to see what was bothering him." So if you could go to slide 11, nothing stands alone. Everything is related to one another. Our past experience, our future aspirations, our current situation, all of our sensory systems are related to one another. I know that we have time for some questions and conversations, so I think I may save a little bit more of my discussion about different kinds of movements and STEM. I do want to just share with you that the handle approach on slide number 12 describes that what we're trying to do is take a non-judgmental observation and see what individuals can give us through what we can see from them. To develop an observation, an interview, and screening that is looking at how the person takes in and processes information to determine what neurodevelopmental pathways are immature, damaged, or not connecting to one another. And through this, develop a screening summary or a developmental profile instead of determining a score and providing a label. And slide number 13, from the screening summary, understanding then emergence of the root causes of the presenting concern. And from this basis, an individual program is designed to enhance function. And caregivers are coached in gentle enhancement. Now, gentle enhancement is very, very important, and it has a lot to do with talking about. It has to do with stopping at the first sign of stress. So what we're trying to do is recognize when somebody is stimulated by their environment and their environment is causing them to become stressed, what are the subtle clues that they're showing me? And the more one has become sensitive to that, perhaps a person tenses up before they start jumping. Perhaps then we can stop the activity when they first tense, rather than when they start to jump. So we try to anticipate these things and stop sooner. And thus, slide number 14, this then is the basis of the handle approach, which is taking individuals on a journey from dysfunction to function. And we can then help extraordinary people do ordinary things. On slide number 15, I just have some contact information for you. I can go into more. Actually, I do want to share with you one way to really think about behavior. I think of as a doorbell. So when you press a doorbell, it's like pushing a buzzer. And there is then an impulse that travels down a wire. And it creates sort of a vibration that travels down that wire. And when it comes to the bell, it then makes a sound. Well, what happens if as that impulse is traveling down that wire, it gets disrupted. And or perhaps there is a wire crossing, or perhaps there is a break in the wire, and so that impulse isn't able to get all the way to the bell. Well, it might just create a vibration that's happening in the wire somewhere in the house that doesn't know where it should go. Think of that as sensory perceptions coming in. I'm perceiving something, I'm hearing something, and I don't know what to do with it. Then that gets rattled. It creates a rattling of energy within a person, and they don't know how to get it out. For example, let's say somebody is undifferentiated in their movements, and so when they write their name, when they pick up a pencil and they start to write their name, their tongue also moves, or their other hand also moves, or their foot moves. So now take that person and have them copy from the blackboard. They're copying the letter A, and as they're copying the letter A, both hands are moving, their tongue is moving, and their foot is moving. The brain is receiving all of that information. All of that information is going into the brain, and the brain is categorizing. The letter A is shaped in this way, and it's shaped with my tongue, it's shaped with both hands, it's shaped with my foot. Now we come to writing the word cat. All right. So the teacher is now asking the person to write the word cat. That person has practiced all of those letters. The person has practiced the sequence of those letters, and they're being asked to write the word cat. I know how to spell the word, C-A-T. How do I write the word? All right, I write it with my tongue. No, there's still nothing on my paper. I write it with my foot. No, there's still nothing on my paper. Okay, well, the teacher has now asked me to write the next word, so now I'm getting agitated. I've got nothing on my paper, so now I know I need to do something with my hands. At this point, I'm so stressed, I'm going to jump up and down and flap my hands around. It's as if that stimulation came in, and it was unable to get itself all the way down the wire, but there is an impulse, there is a stimulation that's being asked to do something. I am now doing something. I may not be doing what you asked me to do, but I am doing something. I am moving my hands. That is another reason why someone might have a repetitive movement. So we talked about looking at repetitive movements as being indications of a sensory system, specifically like the visual system, auditory system. Perhaps the movement is in the chest area, hand flapping like a bird wings, or clenching a fist or rocking. Perhaps the movement is coming with together, the arms are moving together with the body rocking back and forth. Well, if you have a stomach ache, what do? You bend forward, right? And sometimes it feels good to bend forward and to bend back and to bend forward and bend back. A lot of people with dysfunctions have digestive issues and feel discomfort in their abdomen. That might feel better to rock forward and forward and forward and forward. It is disruptive and gives the brain irregular spastic information and makes it harder to function and process, but at least it's relieving that situation that I'm bothered by right now. Another communication that it's telling me something is not working. It's serving a purpose. Another place that behavior can be a communication is, I need downtime. I'm done. I think most people have downtime that they do, whether it's playing cards, whether it's just sitting and zoning and watching the news at the end of the day, whether it's I'm sitting in a meeting and the meeting's pretty long and I can't sit still a long time, and so now I'm tapping my pencil or I'm fiddling with my foot, or chewing gum, or even chain smoking, behaviors that are stimulations that are helping me to attend, helping me to survive. Now, if they've been overloaded for a long time, I might need to do that, just chill out and not take in any meaningful information for a period of time so that I can digest what I have taken in. And that is a typical reason for a sort of a zone out stim behavior, perhaps going over to the corner and just spinning something around and around and around. We used to have this as something that was acceptable in our culture, playing with dice, playing marbles, spinning tops. Repetitive movements used to be socially acceptable and encouraged in children. And there's a lot more judgment around it now. And there is a lot more stress in our environment for people to be processing and dealing with. But it's definitely one of many possible reasons. And I have to admit that it makes it very hard for me to really answer the question for any specific behavior, because it could be, it might be, perhaps, maybe, sometimes, are all really good answers for what is going on for a person when they are demonstrating irregular spastic movements. What I need to do, is start to observe in a very non-judgmental way and ask questions. Is it related to something else? What happened before? What's about to happen? And try to connect the dots and try to see what are the relationships between the different things. So I believe that there are some questions. Minta, perhaps you want to bring some now. And I also received some from you. So we can go through some of those questions.
Very good. I'm going to ask some questions now. That's all right, Elizabeth?
Sure.
Excuse me, in the order that they're coming in. But also I want to remind you that if you are listening in, if you are dialing in, you can raise your hand to ask a question by pressing *2. So once again, if you're dialing in, you can raise your hand to ask a question by pressing *2, and I will try to get to as many of those calls as I can. All right. I have a lot of parents asking very specific things about their children's habits. Jay Armistead from Kitchener is asking, teeth grinding, guttural noises, constant wrapping a string around a stick, and food stuffing at a rapid pace are the things that I am at a loss to help my 16-year-old daughter with. Any insights would be appreciated. Many thanks.
So teeth grinding and noises in the throat frequently are related to tension in the trigeminal nerve. The trigeminal nerve is one of the 12 cranial nerves. It's one of the nerves that the brain pays the most attention to, and it innervates the eyes, the ears, the tongue, the teeth, the nose. It goes into our sensory systems. So when we are bombarded by sensory perceptions and we're stressed by sound, we're stressed by smells, we're stressed by light, that tension can be perceived and registered by the trigeminal nerve. Now, one way that we can relieve tension from the trigeminal nerve is to move our jaw, to move our mouth. And when we grind our teeth, when we bite down and clamp down on our teeth, it affects the pressure in our inner ear. It actually squeezes the little tiny muscles that regulate the tympanic membrane. And it can be an attempt to dampen a hypersensitivity to sound. So trying to relieve hypersensitivity to sound, I don't know if this parent has ever worked with headphones, sound cancellation headphones, but that can be helpful for that kind of a situation. If the person is stuffing food in their mouth, again, it could be a hypersensitivity to sound, that when you swallow, when you chew and swallow, it actually can hurt your ears to hear that sound of swallowing. So that would be the place that I would look first, would be to see if that person had a hypersensitivity to sound, and would there be a way to start working with that? There definitely are some wonderful auditory reintegration resources out there to help with that. The listening program is one. Cranial sacral therapy can be very helpful, and certainly handle activities, especially ones that help to integrate the sense of sound and sense of balance, can be very helpful.
Very good. Cheryl wants to know, she has a 24-year-old that she wants to self-monitor to redirect things like nail biting, picking at face acne. What kind of advice can you give her?
Nail picking, biting, picking on the face, to me looks like tactility, a sensitivity to touch. So I would want to try to integrate the sense of touch. One of the handle activities, face tapping, which in this situation is really impossible to teach without being able to show you. But it, again, it's working with the trigeminal nerve, and it's giving rhythmic, organized stimulation to that nerve pathway to help integrate the sense of touch. It can be really helpful for individuals who are doing things like nail biting and picking at the face to relieve and integrate the sense of touch in the face. Acne, I personally always look at nutritional imbalances. Zinc is one that frequently is imbalanced when somebody has acne, and that can make a huge difference also. And if nail picking has to do with the edges of the nails, like a hangnail, that can also be related to a nutritional deficiency. I would encourage connecting with a naturopath or a nutritionist to look and see if there were some ways to support that area as well.
That's fantastic. Great advice. Thank you. This is a very interesting one. Kathy Pruden of Owensboro, Kentucky, has an 18-year-old son who for the past several years, and mostly at this time of the year, rips his shirts and jeans. On the shirts, he will start with a small hole and leave it at that until the next time he wears it. After wearing it for several hours, then, he will rip it beyond repair. I have sewn some back together in hopes that he would grasp the concept that it's not appropriate to do this. He will still keep tearing them. He rips the jeans from the ankles up to the knees. How do I address this?
Well, I would assume that she's given him shorts to wear. And I would wonder if the shorts are also bothering him. Now, when you are picking at things, it's similar to that last question. Tactility is the thing that comes to mind for me first. And, of course, there's a little edge to that. And each time you fray the edge, there's more edge. And so that means that I'm constantly interested and engaged with that and working with the edge and affecting how it's changing the touch on my body. Mm-hmm. So for this person, it sounds to me like integrating the sense of touch, especially on the limbs, the arms and legs, would be very helpful. Occupational therapy has some great techniques. The brushing and joint compressions frequently can be helpful with that. Handel has slightly different ways to work with the sense of touch that is a little bit more focused on the neurodevelopmental organization of the sense of touch. The brain is related to the body from in a hierarchical way, center to periphery, above to below, dominant to non-dominant. So Handel organizes its tactile integrating activities, such as rhythmic massages, in that way, in an organized way from center to periphery, above to below, dominant to non-dominant, and using very predictable touch, such as the surface of a ball, so that the brain can anticipate. The brain needs to be able to anticipate in order to organize. And as with the seams or the edges of a fray, it's not predictable. It's constantly changing. And any time I move and the pants brush against me, well, that's not predictable either. Another thing that can be very helpful for that kind of situation is to wear tight clothing as the underlayer. In Kentucky, unfortunately, it's probably much warmer than it is here in New England. So that may be harder to convince an 18-year-old to wear skin-tight clothing, but that might be one way to minimize that kind of aggravation on the tactile level.
That is so interesting. we have Asiya from, I hope I'm pronouncing this right, Riyadh. She has a son who's obsessed with water. This is very interesting. He takes him into his mouth like a fountain and spits it out. It is so bad at times that he is wrestling with me to go to the sink to do this. He can play like this for hours if I would let him. I do not know how to break this habit because it is embarrassing when we are out in public. It is dangerous when we are in the pool due to water contamination, and he gets dehydrated because he's playing with his drink too. I need some advice. He is 9.5 years old, autistic child.
So I would hazard a guess that there has to be a lot of tension in the trigeminal nerve again for this individual, and possibly other cranial areas as well. Sucking and blowing are the two primary releases, besides crying, of cranial tension. So when somebody, when you are first trying to get your eyes to work to make the world make sense, as an infant, the best activity you can do is to suck. And Handel incorporates an activity called Crazy Straw, which is a long, thin straw in which you suck, preferably water, with your eyes closed unless you have overconvergence of the eyes, and then you'd not want to have your eyes closed to enhance that, but to stimulate a sucking activity like nursing to help the eyes to focus. Now, once the eyes have been able to come in and to focus, the next developmental activity that an infant does is to blow. And blowing helps the eyes to then diverge, where sucking helps the eyes converge. Blowing has a lot to do with connecting with the rest of the world, reaching out, finding the environment. Blowing also has to do with releasing what I have inside of me. If I want to communicate anything, I have to be able to speak. And speech comes out with the breath. I take in information on the in-breath, and I speak on the out-breath. So the blowing has to do with both communication and with visual connection with the world and with release of cranial tension. So those are the areas that I would look at to see. I would probably recommend connecting with a craniosacral therapist to evaluate cranial tension to see if that's coming into play and see if the part of the release has to do with tension. I would want to experiment with some sucking and blowing activities and see if this child is really just seeking opportunities to suck and blow, if we can give other more meaningful activities, whether that would saturate that need. And also to stimulate the trigeminal nerve through tapping or vibration to give it more stimulation in perhaps a more organized way that would be helpful. Again, face tapping, which is a Handel activity, comes to mind, as well as sucking and blowing. As far as hydration, one popular way to deal with somebody who is having a hard time with liquids is to add a product called Thicket, which doesn't decrease the hydration ability of the liquid, but it turns it into more like a jello, which, yes, can be played with in the mouth, but would be a different experience and might diminish some of those behaviors. I can't guarantee it, but it's something to experiment with anyway. Those are some things that come to mind with that question.
Just to clarify, You're saying that if this mother were to offer more appropriate ways of her son sucking and blowing, that would likely decrease it would decrease his obsession and his public spitting of water.
You know, I think that's true, and in general, we found that to be true with the Handel activities, that the behavior is showing us that I need something here. Intuitively, I'm seeking out this behavior because it serves a purpose for me. And the way that the person ends up acting frequently is random or not really giving the brain as specific information as would be useful. So if we can take that as, and then translate it into what the brain might really need, and give instead the brain some very specific rhythmic organized stimulation specifically to the nerves that are being stimulated, that then can free up the need to do that behavior. And right. it definitely can reduce the behavior then in public or at other times of the day. Yes.
So until this mother gets the proper treatment, do you think she should? I hear a lot of the parents saying they want to stop their child from doing something. If it's actually serving a purpose, do you advise this mother to stop the child or encourage it, or, you know, in the meantime until she can get the right activities for him?
I would encourage the activity in a time and place when it works for her.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe in the bathtub. I know many parents get concerned about their child drinking the bathtub water, and so then they have a bottle of drinking water in the bath with the child so that the child can have water that they can drink along with them in the bath. And then they can do that activity as much as they need to in that place that works.
That is really great advice.
Yeah.
Really great advice, Elizabeth. Now, there is... this is something that many children do. Amy from Atlanta says, I notice my son does a lot of running around the house and the yard, flapping his arms like a bird, but he's happy when he's doing it. He's 12. She's curious to why he does that. She thinks he wants to be a bird. What do you have to say to this mother?
Well, I definitely have seen, are you still there? I've definitely seen many children who act like animals at some point in their development. It's actually an extremely appropriate developmental stage for children to go through sometime between the age of 2 and 5. And with autistic individuals, often their development is delayed, and they go through normal developmental stages later. So part of me is saying, wonderful, delightful, that your child has reached that developmental stage. There definitely is a possibility that this child is using that as a communication. If the child is happy, it's possible that it is more of just an energy release, a freeing up energy. Perhaps the school day, there's been a lot going on, or at another time during the day, and now I need to release what I have pent up inside me. Flapping the arms like a bird, to me, is in the region of the lungs, especially when it's being done when running around the house or the yard. I would say that there's probably an interest in stimulating respiration and increasing the oxygenation of the blood through that activity. So releasing energy, increasing oxygenation, helping the lungs to breathe more deeply and more fully would be the things that come to mind to me with that child.
That's I would never think of that. That's really interesting to think of the lungs relating to the arms. Do you think that this is very common? You see a lot of autistic children flapping their arms. Can you make any connection to a visual stimulus? Do you think it might have anything to do with another sensory seeking, like
I said before, depending on where the flapping is, sometimes is related to which system the person is trying to connect to. So mm-hmm. I just said that the arms flapping like a bird wings to me sounds like it's flapping in that middle region, in the area where the lungs are. That's why I think perhaps arms flapping like a bird might have to do with breathing and with oxygenation. If the hands are higher and closer to the eyes, perhaps it has to do with either increasing or decreasing or controlling the visual stimulation. If the hand flapping is near the ears, it could be related to equalizing pressure in the ear or dealing with auditory stimulation. If the hand flapping is closer to the abdomen, it could be related to abdominal distress or a disruption of one of the internal organs functioning in the lower abdomen. So, yeah, depends on where and how. I was just saying this particular story sounded to me like lungs.
Right. I asked because I was wondering why you see some children flapping higher and some children flapping lower. That answer made total sense. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
Here is some parents trying to help their children. Of course, we all want to know that we're doing something that helps them. This is Sharon Selesronsky from Flushing, New York says, how do you know if the behavior being displayed is actually stimming or OCD related? I have tried, two-part question. I have tried to direct my son's OCD behavior of walking back and forth through the apartment by giving him a small trampoline with a handlebar in his room for when he needs it. Am I helping him or hurting him?
Mm-hmm. Good question. Absolutely, a very fine line between stimming and OCD. And I think that, in a way, it's one and the same as well. When it is too much and when people become concerned is when the person is no longer able to connect with the rest of the world, or perhaps when they're unable to stop and become redirected. And as the person becomes more and more engaged and more connected, the behaviors tend to diminish. Judith Bluestone spent a lot of time doing obsessive compulsive behaviors, like turning her bike upside down and spinning them round and round, and banging her hips on the floor and jumping on a pogo stick. And one of the stories with Judith is that when she was 8 years old, the cranial bones in her head grew incorrectly, and the bones fused together at her ears, and she was no longer able to hear. She became physically deaf. And when her family found this out, her mother was baking some cookies, and Judith was playing with her back to her mother, and her mother pulled the tray of cookies out of the oven. The cookie tray slipped out of her mother's hand, fell to the floor. Her mother screamed. Her sister and her father came running from the basement and the other places in the house, and Judith sat there with her back to her mother playing with her toys and didn't move. And the family said, wait a second, why didn't she hear that? So she was completely deaf. And the intervention that they did at that time was to drill a hole through the bone so that she could hear. And so she went from not being able to hear anything to being able to hear everything and being bombarded by loud sounds. Now, if you know anybody who's given a hearing aid, often the first thing that they do when they're given a hearing aid is to turn it off because the sounds bombard them and are overwhelming and they can't tolerate it and they become stressed by too much sound. Well, if it's not that you're given a hearing aid but you have a hole drilled through the bone into your head, you can't dampen that sound. But Judith intuitively found that rapid movement of the fluid in her inner ear was able to cause an impaction of the fluid in her inner ear, which stopped the ability to process that amount of stimulation. And so she could control and dampen her processing of sound by jumping on a pogo stick. And so for a year, she spent as much time as possible jumping on a pogo stick. She had a very forgiving teacher who let her jump on a pogo stick in the back of the classroom. Anywhere she went, down the street, down the sidewalk, down, up and down the stairs to go shopping for her mother, she went on a pogo stick. And after a year of jumping on the pogo stick and dampening and controlling the amount of sound that she was receiving, she was able to diminish the need for that behavior, and she could integrate that system enough that she was able to move forward in her life. So somebody who is needing to do a lot of repetitive movement, it can be that they are trying to diminish, control how much stimulation they're receiving in order to process a certain amount or what they've already received. So giving them a trampoline or giving them permission to run around and do obsessive movements can be a way to help them manage and moderate their experiences. And at the same time, it's very helpful to give them not just the random behavior and random movements, but also very specific, organized, rhythmic stimulation and meaningful connections so that they can mature out of the need to do that. So if the person is needing to do that behavior because they're bombarded by sound, then it's appropriate to guide them through organized auditory stimulation to help them integrate the sense of sound so that they will be less bombarded by sound and less having less need to control it. Likewise, if they're bombarded by visual stimulation or by tactile stimulation, you need to integrate and organize those sensory systems so that the person doesn't need to unwind so much and control their environment so much. And at the same time, working with diet and nutrition and detoxification can be an incredibly important part of that whole process, because the stimulation can also be coming from a toxic overload that's internal. I've definitely seen jumping and stimming behaviors as a result of food that somebody has eaten, or a result of smells that somebody has had smelled, or a toxin in their environment. Changing the carpets in the house and having off-gassing from the carpets can definitely put somebody into more obsessive compulsive behaviors and stimming behaviors. So it's really important to look at not just the sensory external perceptions, but how the person is perceiving internally, and working with the diet, nutrition, and toxic overload as well.
Very good. On a related note, helping or hurting children, our children, what do you think of this? Sharon, another question from Sharon Flushing. She gives her son what she calls hushers for his ears when we are in an environment that will assault his ears. Am I helping him or hurting him by giving him a crutch?
Well, that's a good question.
Mm-hmm.
So hushers, I'm assuming, are like sound-canceling headphones. There's a lot of different ways to look at that question. I really admire the Sunrise approach, which says to reduce the stimulation as much as possible so the person can begin to function. And they strongly advocate for having individuals who are hypersensitive to their world spending time in a very low stimulation environment until they can tolerate that and engage with people in that environment and then gradually move out into the world. I think our society, our culture, doesn't really give us permission to change our environment so much. And so we frequently assault unconsciously our children and ourselves by doing things like driving in a car or going to the store. Our environment, you know, there's so many fluorescent lights in grocery stores. There's smells. You walk down the aisle with all the cleaning supplies. It's incredibly toxic going to the grocery store. And we constantly tell ourselves, I can do this. I can survive. I need to survive in this environment. And we don't give ourselves permission to stop. And we also don't give our children permission to stay home. We feel it's not safe for them to just sit at home under a tree all day long if that's what they need to do. We don't often have trees in our backyard or safe backyards for our children to be in. So our environment is not one that is really serving all of us in an ideal, optimal way. So given that, if the point of development is to mature, and everyone, if it's an innate capacity in human beings to develop and to mature, I need to be able to mature and process my environment without being overloaded. If I'm overloaded, I'm going to shut down. So sound-canceling headphones, yes, they're a crutch, but they are permitting learning and growth in certain areas. And that in itself, I think, is a tremendous gift. If you don't give those sound-canceling headphones and you subject the person to walking down the street, then they're not going to be able to function, and that's going to be self-limiting to their experience and their ability to find their way into the world. So I would say, yes, that is fine. But I think it's important to recognize why you're doing it and what purpose is it serving, and recognize that it is a crutch and that there are other things to be addressing as well, not just the sound, but also the very related system of the sense of balance. Integrating that as well may be very, very important for this person to increase their ability to tolerate sounds. Another system that's directly related to hypersensitivity to sound is hypersensitivity to light. When we are able to have our eyes focus, then we are able to focus our hearing better as well. I don't know if you, do you know anybody, Minta, who when they, they're talking to you, they say, wait a second, let me put on my glasses, then I'll be able to hear you better.
Yes, I'm one of those people.
Okay, so when when your eyes are more focused, your ears are able to focus better. Because
so there is actually logic to it. I wondered why I could hear better when my glasses were on.
It's not just logic. It's actually physiological. There's a little window in the midbrain called the colliculus that the auditory nerve and the visual nerve both go through. And it's part related to our autonomic nervous system, our fight or flight and rest and digest. And when we are in fight or flight, that little window tells our eyes to pay attention to our ears so we can find where the enemy is. And when we are relaxed and we're able to accept the world and digest, then that little window tells the ears to pay attention to the eyes. And so there's a direct relationship between the two. So if somebody is hypersensitive to light or has irregularity in their visual processing system, that can affect their sensitivity to sound. So again, we come back to the nothing stands alone. Everything is related to each other. And one of the problems with the way that we're often working with individuals with challenges is that we are working from one little area to another and not looking at everything at the same time and integrating all of the systems together.
No. Very good. On the topic of hypersensitivity, Sarah is a in-home behavior specialist, and she works with a child who's autistic, and when his family starts to return home and dinner is being prepared, there's a lot going on and it's very loud. The boy begins to bang his hands on the table and walls, and he kicks the walls and tables. He seems to be making more noise in an already chaotic environment. Any advice, input?
Yeah, it sounds to me like it's possible here that the sound of the environment is overwhelming to him, and so he's doing something to control the sound. If I am in control of the sound, I'm not bothered by it. And so he could be making noise in order to cancel out the other noise. It would be an interesting experiment with that boy to use sound-canceling headphones to see if that made a difference for him. Now, of course, that only works with somebody who can tolerate touch on their head and on their ears, so they certainly don't work for everybody. But it would be an interesting experiment. You could also optimize when you take your walk with the child so that the child is gone during that transition time and returns when everything has settled down so that the child is out of that chaotic transition.
Those are great suggestions, Elizabeth. Fantastic. Speaking about skin sensitivity, this is a very interesting question. Jody from Bradford, UK says, my 7-year-old is sensitive to water. He complains that the bath water is too hot when it's about 25 degrees Celsius, like a very cold swimming pool, but then same temperature is too cold to wash his hair. Consequently, bath time is a nightmare and unpleasant for all. What can I do to help make this easy for him? I suspect, this is very interesting, I suspect when he's saying it's hot that it actually feels too wet. Any advice, please?
Mm-mm. Interesting. Mm-hmm. Or he doesn't know what the word hot and cold means. Those could be concepts that he has reversed. It's not unusual for an individual to have the opposite experience. And the hot and cold receptors in the skin also are very close. There's been some very interesting psychosomatic experiments with people who have been told that they're being touched with a branding iron and they're actually being touched by an ice cube and they still get a burn from it. So there is a level of perception involved there that is above and beyond the actual temperature of the water. It does sound challenging to me. to work with. My feeling is that trying to integrate the sense of touch would be very helpful for this child. I'd have to think about that one a little bit. It's not one that I have faced in a while. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, I thought you'd enjoy that question.
It's a good one. If I come up with something else, I'll let you know.
I'm sure you will. That's a very interesting situation that she has there. I love the sensitivity and the intuitiveness of these parents. It's very touching. I want to remind the audience that if you're calling in, if you're dialing in, you can raise your hand by pressing *2, and then I will see your hand up and I can call on you. While I'm waiting for some calls, let's see some more questions. I'm glad to see that there were educators talking and they're asking questions, and family members, other family members. This is a very interesting one. Lori says, for my nephew, he seems to like to have an object that he can just hold in his peripheral vision and move it back and forth. He doesn't seem upset when he is doing this. It's almost like he calms himself with it. My sister goes to great lengths to take away anything that he can do that with. Should we be looking for what causes him to twiddle the object or just let him do it if it calms him down?
Well, I think we're going back to some questions that were similar to other parents, which is, what is my goal here? Is my goal to have my child conform to society, or is my goal to have my child be able to be relaxed and calm and begin to develop and mature? And I think depending on how you answer that question will help to guide you in what to do next. Still, I think it's very helpful to look and see what is going on. Why is the child moving something around in their peripheral vision? A young child who's moving things in the peripheral vision, it can be that they're trying to integrate their visual system. The peripheral vision tends to be an earlier development than focused vision, and it can be something that takes work to find that focused vision. There's some very interesting vision therapy techniques of using prism glasses and masking tape and caps and visors to constrain the visual field to help the eyes find just that focused vision. So moving things around in the visual field a lot of times has to do with trying to find and integrate the visual field. Do you want to stop somebody who's trying to integrate their visual field? My sense is, no, I don't really want to stop them from trying to integrate their visual field. Do I want to understand what they're trying to do and perhaps give them something that's more efficient, more effective? Absolutely, yes. So a big question for me would be visual processing. Is it maturing in an organized way? Does it need help? Development happens regardless, as long as the systems are supported. And it's like I said before, it's an innate capacity in a human being. When we have adequate support for our systems of nutrition and an environment, and we're not stressed, and we're receiving information that we can process and we can organize, we develop and we mature. When the information that we're receiving is overwhelming or doesn't make sense, we often become stressed, and when we're stressed, we stop developing, we stop maturing. So the typically developing individual that's developing in a healthy way is marching their way along one piece after another and moving forward in their development. When they get stuck due to stress, due to trauma, due to illness, due to breaking an arm, due to something, then the development stops and can regress. We need to go in and start to gently nudge when we see things not maturing in the way that they need to. So if you see a behavior continuing for more than 6 months, chances are that person has not been able to use that behavior to help make the next developmental step. And it's an important thing then to take a break, step back, and try to assess what that behavior is trying to do and how can I get somebody to help me nudge them in a more effective or a more appropriate way. So is it then, if that behavior has been going on for more than 6 months, is it time to engage a developmental optometrist or a vision therapist? Is it time to go back and do an earlier developmental activity like sucking and blowing that naturally help the eyes to focus and connect and find their central vision and peripheral vision in an integrated, organized way? So those are some questions that would come to mind for me if I see somebody who's doing a lot of visual stimulation.
Funny how it's all integrated, isn't it? I love it. I'm so happy we have a caller who'd like to call in from Minnesota. Let's go to the phones now, and we will hear from, if I can manage to do this. Caller, are you on the line from Minnesota? Where is Minnesota? Caller from Minnesota, are you on the line?
Yes, I am.
Can you hear me? Hello.
Can you hear me?
Yes. Hi, what's your name?
My name is Anne.
Hi, Anne. What would you like to ask Elizabeth?
Well, this is more an observation that I wanted to give you, and that is I have been working with my son who has recently been diagnosed with PDD-NOS, pervasive development disorder not otherwise specified. And so the last year of my life has been a real learning curve for me. In the process, I have learned about my own disability and have been tested and have found out that I have Asperger's. And so much of what has been shared today is like just, oh, my gosh. It's like light bulbs going off all over for me. My observation is this, though, as someone who, you know, can focus on one thing, and then when other things happen, I'm distracted, and it's hard to refocus on what the speaker is saying. And it's real interesting because I listened to the first session that was going on, and as you, the moderator, I didn't know that you were moderating, but I heard this laughing in the background, and and I'm thinking somebody's speaker is on because I don't understand what's going on here. So I was totally distracted in the first presentation. And then in this one, the moderator has been much more quiet, but has been included with the speaker. So it's been a normal transition for me. So I'm just offering that as an observation. I don't know if I need to say anything more, and I hope I'm making sense, and I really don't want to offend anybody. I don't know if this pertains to the speaker or to the moderator or both. That's my statement. And
well,
I'm going to mute so that you can respond, and I think that's star six, so I'm going to do that.
Okay. Thank you, Amy. I just wanted to say, Elizabeth, I'll let you address that question as well, but I'm so sorry about the technical difficulties that we had in the first webinar. I'm the moderator, and it was my first actual webinar, and I was trying to Skype, and the sound quality was very poor. I didn't know how to mute, and so there was a lot of background noise, and I want to thank you for your observation. Obviously, we've got the problem figured out much better now. This webinar is going much better. I do apologize for any distress that might have caused you. It wasn't fun for me either, and I'm sure it was hard for Ron to speak. I've invited him back to our next webinar because we had such technical difficulties. You brought up an interesting point about your recently being diagnosed with Asperger's, and what you were talking about relates very much to, I believe, with sound sensitivity. Elizabeth, would you like to address that?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question that you bring up, Minta, that I feel like many of these labels, it's hard to say that they address a particular or they're related to a particular sensitivity, because individuals with labels frequently present in completely different ways from one another. I do, however, feel like most people have some kind of sensitivity of some kind to their environment and frequently find that they are overwhelmed by their environment. And the point that Anne made that to me was most interesting was how parents frequently have challenges that are similar or a variation on the theme from what their children have. And that a lot of times I see children coming as the problem, and the parents, funnily enough, they discover that they start to find that they are able to heal their own issues when they work with their children. One of my favorite stories is a father of a teenager with Asperger's, and he started doing his son's program on his own. As his son was doing his program, the father was doing them with the son, and then the father started doing the son's activities as well. And the father called me up and said, "You know what? I have been in psychotherapy for many years, and I have come to a plateau, and I've been unable to get further along in certain issues. But a few months into doing my son's activities, and changes are happening in what I'm able to do. And professionally, he was a composer. Professionally, his ability to compose music completely changed because he became more integrated by doing his son's program." And that goes back to mental rehearsal, where I mentioned before that that boy was seeing the fan on the top of the shelf and how that thought of the fan was attacking him, was causing him stress. Well, the same thing can happen when we have people in our environment that are acting out. We can imagine how much that movement would bother us, or the sound of our child doing repetitive movements is stressing our hypersensitivity to sound. So when you bring a handle program into the home, it becomes much more effective than having a therapist somewhere else do the therapy, because the parents become the caregivers. The parents become the therapists. And the parents are taught also how to work with their own sensitivities so that everybody is gently nudged into being more integrated and hopefully being less reactive to each other. And so siblings can be engaged and appreciate the program as well as the parents. So I really appreciate, Anne, that you called in and that you shared that, because it's a really valuable observation to acknowledge that that we're all in this together. And it's really important to work on our own stress and our own needs as well.
Thank you, Elizabeth. I want to remind us we have about 8 more minutes left for the webinar, so I've got a lot of questions. I was wondering if you could just kind of give me, some of it relates to things you've spoken about before, and if you could just give me some quick hits. I want to make sure that people get their questions answered. Asiya says, her son bites on his thumb every time he gets angry or excited. His thumb is very swollen from the bites and red. I am not sure why he does that. I'm trying to redirect him, but he always goes right back to thumb biting. What can you say about that?
Thumbs are generally related to the sense of touch, integrating the sense of touch. It's grounding. When you put your thumb in your mouth, you're stimulating taste, touch, and smell, our foundation support systems. So it's a clear indication that he's overwhelmed by probably auditory visual stimulation, and he's trying to ground himself through stimulating his sense of taste, touch, and smell. Reducing hypersensitivity to sound and light would be one thing. Helping to integrate the sense of touch would be another thing. Giving him something else to bite on and chew on. Speech therapists have wonderful chewing tubes that can be very helpful. Some children can tolerate and appreciate having a necklace with like a worry stone kind of soft item on them that they can pick up and chew on when they need to, instead of biting on their own selves or their clothing.
Great. We have Sumita is an educator in India. This is a very interesting question. She says, I work with children with autism here in India. I've enjoyed your presentation immensely. A child I work with carries his bag 24 hours, 7 days a week. He gets up at night, too, asking for his bag. Would it be a need for proprioception? What, according to you, could be the purpose behind this behavior?
Can you spell that? Is it B-A-G, bag?
Bag, yes. He has, I guess, a school bag, and he carries
okay.
it with him all the time and gets up in the middle of the night and asks for it.
Some kind of a bag. Okay. Yeah, mm-hmm. I would definitely guess that that has something to do with time and space, that need to know where he is, proprioception. A lot of times integrating the sense of touch and proprioceptive sense by massaging the back space can be very helpful, especially as part of a bedtime routine. Things like compression, rolling up in a blanket can also be very helpful for that kind of behavior. I would also look at nutrition. Nutritional deficiencies can be present by behavior at night. You need to have adequate nutrition in order to sleep well. One combination that's important at night is calcium, magnesium, especially taken at night. I don't know if you remember the good old milk and honey when you go to sleep at night is something that helps you sleep better.
Mm-hmm.
That tradition is magnesium, calcium, and potassium, things that are helpful for your body to have, for your internal organs to mature and develop while you're sleeping. If you don't have enough of them, it's hard to really rest and mature. Epsom salts baths can be fantastic evening activities to help bring calm and rest for the night.
Very good. Couple more quick hits. We have about 5 more minutes. Jennifer wants to know, is there a suggestion for constant hand clapping?
Constant hand clapping?
Yes, constant hand clapping.
Could be managing the sound in my environment. I need to be in control of the sound that I'm hearing. Depending on where the person is, I've seen people clap up close to objects, like close to the window or close to the door, and that can be more of a proprioceptive sense. I'm using sound to tell me where I am in space. So it's using almost like an echolocation. I'm listening to the bouncing of the sound back to me to help me know where I am. Otherwise, it could be an energy release. It could be an overwhelm. I'm trying to free up. It's like that buzzer. I need to do something. I'm not sure what I should do. I'm going to clap my hands because you told me to sit down, and I don't know how to sit down, so I'm going to clap my hands instead. Could be. It's hard to know. There's a lot of possibilities with that, depending on how, when, and where, and what just happened.
Great. A lot of parents have been asking about aggressive behaviors, and how would you handle CWJ from Dayton wants to know, how would you handle a kid that likes to take sticks or rocks and damage cars?
Sticks and rocks and damage cars.
Mm-hmm.
Well, one way to see that is that that's an invasion of the tactile sense. I'm invading the sense of touch of this car. I'm damaging the surface area of this car. And so it has to do with feeling a disruption in their tactile sense of themselves and not knowing how to manage or control that. So for me, I would say that a behavior intervention that could be helpful would be to integrate the sense of touch for that person, to help them not feel so assaulted and stressed by their boundaries, their sense of touch. Massage, rhythmic tapping, again, the sensory integration brushing activity could be helpful for that person depending on how they respond to it. Another thing would be perhaps there is something about the experience of being in a car that is stressful for that person, and they can't be in control when they're in the car. They may feel their sense of balance is completely off. They may feel disrupted in their proprioceptive sense. They may feel assaulted by the movement, by the vibrations. And in order to tolerate the car, they have to block and put all of that on the back burner. They're not in control. So when they get out of the car or before they get into the car, they remember how assaulting that car was, that experience of being in the car was. And so now they're getting back at the car. And they're saying, you hurt me, you damaged me, you made me feel awful last time I was in you, so now I'm going to punish you for it.
Makes sense. I would never have thought of that. Thank you very much, Elizabeth. That was really, that was so informative. That was just so helpful, I'm sure, to so many people. We have just about a moment left, so I'm going to ask you if you would like to wrap things up and have any last things to say to our audience.
I just really want to thank you for this opportunity. I really appreciate it. It's been a lot of fun. I'm sure that there are more questions than answers, as there always are. And so you're welcome to get in touch with me via email, efrisch@sovr.net, or you can call me. My phone number is 413-528-0477. The Handle website, handle.org, has wonderful resources and links to practitioners around the world. The support number is 541-639-1588. And there are many, many very insightful Handle practitioners around. We give trainings. We provide consultations in schools, in homes, in programs, in clinics. And looking forward to providing you with further support.
Thank you so much. And to the callers,